Today is October the 3rd, 2018. Do you know who has your personal data besides Facebook? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data? Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive, prn.fm, and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive. WBAI is in a membership drive this evening, and we are preempted, but we will be back on WBAI next week. Facebook reset logins for millions of customers as it dealt with a data breach that may have exposed nearly 50 million accounts. The breach was caused by an exploit of three bugs in Facebook's code that were introduced with the addition of a new video uploader in July of 2017. Facebook since patched the vulnerabilities and it revoked access tokens for a total of 90 million users. Mark Zuckerberg said that the attack targeted the View As feature, code that allowed people to see what other people were seeing when they viewed their profile. Mark Zuckerberg said attackers did try to query Facebook APIs, but they do not know if any private information was exposed. Yet they can say emphatically no credit card data or other information was exposed. Facebook contacted the FBI and other law enforcements after identifying the nature of the attack. After turning off the View As feature and patching the other bugs, Facebook security then deauthorized all access tokens from the 50 million accounts that had been breached. They also deauthorized access tokens for another 40 million that had been accessed with the View As feature to ensure no other accounts were compromised. While no evidence of further data access has been found, the investigation is still in its early stage. They could not say yet whether specific types of users were targeted. Mark Zuckerberg emphasized that Facebook was taking the breach seriously and the company was aggressive in going after the breach. The CEO promised further details as the investigation went forward. There has been questions about how Facebook itself uses customer data, including the discovery that Facebook had been routinely collecting full call logs and other data from some mobile users, and Facebook acknowledged that it provided phone numbers used for two-factor authentication to advertisers for the purpose of targeting users with advertisements. And Facebook's Onavo, that's O-N-A-V-O, that's their VPN application, was pulled off from the Apple App Store in August because it's being used by Facebook to collect data about users' mobile applications usage. What's the purpose of a VPN if it's spying on you? How can you tell if you were in this breach? And more importantly, what can you do about it? If you logged into Facebook from a smartphone app or web browser and have to re-enter your login information, you may have been affected by the breach. But, on the other hand, maybe not. Facebook said 50 million user accounts had tokens grabbed and that would allow attackers to gain access to an account without a username and password. In other words, they really don't know how much of a breach it was. However, Facebook reset account sessions for another 40 million users for whom it has a record that someone used this exploitable feature, even if it believes that the use wasn't malicious. Facebook said passwords weren't leaked, and it hasn't reset passwords for accounts. Because you don't control tokens, there's no way to prevent the credential hijacking at Facebook. And no way exists for individuals to prevent another one in the future. However, after any sort of login theft, it's wise to reset your password. And my editorial comment is, if you're worried, don't use Facebook. Like anything else, you know the risk. If you want to continue to use Facebook, be my guest. Many of us have had our cell phones bombarded with spam calls that trick you into answering by spoofing a local number. The purpose of being so that you don't see the 1-800 prefix or something similar to something that you already know that exists with a real person. Those kinds of spoof calls seem to multiply each day, and there's an endless string of them, and there's basically very little you can do about it. And it leaves us helpless to stop them beyond blocking each number or just never answering your phone. The FCC is finally moving to take action and has proposed a first-of-its-kind fine against one company accused of engaging in such practice. The proposed, and I repeat, this is only proposed, they haven't done it yet, the proposed $37.5 million penalty is against an Arizona-based company called Affordable Enterprises, which the commission says made 2.3 million of these marketing calls using spoofed local numbers. According to the commission, this company's effort started in 2016 and ran for a little more than a year. Some calls are also said to have some from unassigned numbers or numbers from burner phones, which would also violate caller ID laws because the actual caller's name and number were hidden. The Arizona company can still fight or settle with the FCC, which is why the fine remains a proposal for now. Meanwhile, in related news, we also have word that the FCC is finalizing an $82 million fine against a single telemarketer who made 21 million calls in an effort to sell health insurance. Unlike the other instance, this effort used unassigned phone numbers instead of spoofing existing local numbers. It is predicted that almost half of all U.S. mobile traffic in 2019 will be just scam calls. These fines could help to deter some bad actors, but ultimately they won't be enough. Many robocalls now originate overseas, which eliminates what the FCC can do to fight them. If you're wondering what's happened to the internet, it seems like big tech has overtaken it, taken over its ownership, controlled its content, violated privacy, or not cared at all about privacy, and government has also taken over it. That's not what the original intent of the World Wide Web was when it was invented by Tim Berners-Lee. And last week, he had said that he would launch his vision for an alternative web. Tim Berners-Lee, last Saturday, is launching an alternative web, and this timing fits right in with what Facebook has been doing. Tim Berners-Lee is the inventor of the World Wide Web, and he's laying out his vision to create a new decentralized web. Berners-Lee has expressed his discontent with the way his invention has been abused by powerful entities to pursue their own agenda. He wants to give users more personal control over their data and apps using his new platform. Following the news of massive data breach at Facebook, which affected over 50 million users, Berners-Lee's announcement was well-timed. Tim Berners-Lee invented the World Wide Web, and for a while now, he's been trying to break it. In a blog posted on Medium, Berners-Lee outlined what he's been up to and amounts to a manifesto for a new, fairer internet. His intervention was well-timed just a day earlier. Facebook provided a reminder of exactly the kind of thing that Berners-Lee is kicking against when it revealed the details of a massive data breach affecting 50 million users. Berners-Lee said that for all the good we've achieved, the web has evolved into an engine of inequity and division swayed by powerful forces who use it for their own agendas. Berners-Lee wrote, reflecting on his invention, "Today I believe we reach a critical tipping point, and that powerful change for the better is possible and necessary." Berners-Lee has been a vocal opponent of big tech companies abusing user data, calling for more regulation and saying he was devastated by the Cambridge Analytica scandal. He hopes to put the genie back in the bottle with a two-pronged approach. Firstly, he pointed to his open source project Solid, that's S-O-L-I-D, which he has been working on for over the past few years. With Solid, Berners-Lee hopes to give users much more control over their data, allowing them to decide which of their apps can access it. Solid is a platform built using the existing web. It gives every user a choice about where data is stored, which specific people and groups can access select elements, and which apps you can use. He also launched a new company, Inrupt, I-N-R-U-P-T, which will provide a commercial structure within which to push Solid forward. InRupt's success is totally aligned to Solid's success, he wrote. InRupt will be the infrastructure allowing Solid to flourish. Its mission is to provide commercial energy and an ecosystem to help protect the integrity and quality of the new webs built on Solid. InRupt's CEO and Berners-Lee's partner is John Bruce, who was formerly CEO at a cybersecurity company, Resilient, which was acquired by IBM in 2016. Berners-Lee said that he was proud to announce that his next venture, InRupt, InRupt's mission is to ensure that Solid becomes widely adopted by developers, businesses, and eventually everyone, that it becomes part of the fabric of the web. As optimistic as he is, as with anything else, people will try to game the system, and hopefully this does not get gamed. Let's get back to basics. What is 5G? There's been a lot of competition among carriers to be the world's first 5G commercial network. Verizon's the first major carrier to claim that title by launching a 5G home network, but their mobile 5G service plans remains to be seen until next year, 2019. Meanwhile, AT&T, T-Mobile, and Sprint have been building out their networks to support mobile 5G, and hardware makers like Huawei, Xiaomi have been busy developing 5G smartphones as well. We'll definitely start to see more companies racing to 5G in the coming months. Verizon announced it was working to bring 5G home internet service to a few U.S. cities last November, and they opened up pre-orders last month for residents to sign up. The companies made good on their promise to launch the service on October the 1st, and installations are starting for residents in Houston, Indianapolis, Los Angeles, and Sacramento. Customers will be able to access typical Wi-Fi speeds around 300 megabits per second and peak speeds up to 1 gigabits per second. As part of its rollout, Verizon is offering 3 months of its 5G home service for free, which would then cost $50 a month for existing Verizon customers and $70 for non-Verizon customers. The company is also offering a free Chromecast or Apple TV 4K and 3 months of YouTube TV. The service comes with installation included and first access to 5G mobile devices when they become available in a user's area. I can't wait. Whatever happened to Sprint and WiMAX? Back in the early 2000s, there was the development of a new wireless technology known as WiMAX, short for Worldwide Interoperability for Microwave Access. The new technology was standardized by the IEEE as 802.16 or 802.16, and through the mid-2000s it was continuously updated. The WiMAX Forum promoted the technology and established a certification program for products to ensure interoperability, and WiMAX got lots of attention and many thought it would be the next Wi-Fi. WiMAX's original target was apparently wireless internet access, an alternative to cable TV and DSL, especially in rural areas where good internet access was not typically available. It was considered a prime candidate for 4G cellular beyond CDMA and GSM. Sprint chose WiMAX for their long-range infrastructure, but then along came long-term evolution, that's LTE, while WiMAX did make it in the 4G cell phone business with Sprint and some carriers outside the United States, most other and all major carriers adopted LTE. Eventually, even Sprint has been changing its networks over to LTE and phasing out its WiMAX phone systems. Yet, WiMAX is still around. It is still widely used for wireless internet access, especially outside the United States. There are hundreds of WiMAX installations worldwide, but not so many in the U.S. One main wireless internet service provider was Clearwire, or Clear, a division of Sprint that still widely deploys WiMAX throughout the United States. As for the data rate, speeds up to 1 gigabits are possible with the latest versions. WiMAX is alive and well, but currently living in the shadow of LTE. It is a great wireless technology that found its own niche, but it could really become an alternative technology for the Internet of Things, that's IoT, as that movement comes into its own. But that's another story. WiMAX technology put Sprint a decade behind its competitors in wireless technology. From relatively poor network coverage to a failed 4G initiative, Sprint experienced several significant missteps throughout the last 10 years. Sprint's LTE network coverage pales in comparison to Verizon's, AT&T, and T-Mobile's. It even pales in comparison to the carrier's general coverage map, which covers most of the United States. Then again, Sprint put itself in this position when it went all in on WiMAX in 2008, as its first foray into 4G instead of LTE. Limited adoption and less than adequate real-world speeds led to Sprint's decision to shut down its WiMAX network in 2016. Realizing it backed the wrong horse, Sprint got to work on its LTE network in 2011 and had it fully functional by early 2014. By then, however, Verizon, AT&T, and T-Mobile already fleshed out their LTE networks and continually built upon them ever since. From every viewpoint, Sprint has been working from behind for almost a decade. If the merger with T-Mobile is successful, the new entity would reportedly capture 54% of the prepaid market. Then again, the U.S. Department of Justice reportedly contacted smaller wireless operators to get their take on the potential merger. The fear is that if T-Mobile-Sprint merger goes through, prepaid plans will become more expensive. Seeing how the prepaid market mainly consists of lower-income consumers, price increases would become very problematic for consumers and prepaid carriers alike. There's also the problem of one less carrier, which would look bad for a limited market that already lacks competition. T-Mobile and Sprint argue that the merger will help them better compete against Verizon and AT&T. It all hinges on the FCC, which currently has put a pause on its review process due to new information that's being made available from T-Mobile and Sprint. What are your thoughts? I'd be happy to hear from you at hank@pcradioshow.org. Featuring Health Tech Insider feature segments from Dr. Alfred Poor. He will be covering artificial intelligence, diagnosis, disease from eye scans, and genetic disorders from face photos. And he will cover low-cost health tags attached to your clothes so you don't have to remember to wear them. Huh?
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
I've got a couple stories tonight about big data and medical applications. Basically, digital electronics has made it possible to create all kinds of data about the human body and what's going on with it. The problem is that while this can give us a lot more information, it's also a lot more information for physicians and other people to go through. So what artificial intelligence can do is it can look at these large data sets and it can find correlations within them that a human might miss. This could make diagnoses more accurate, faster, and could lead to sooner treatment of disease, which could result in better outcomes. And we're already seeing lots of cases where that's happening. Well, one of the interesting things that's happened recently, there's a project that's been done by a company called DeepMind. Now, you may recognize that name. DeepMind is a spinoff from Alphabet, which is the parent company of Google. And DeepMind is the artificial intelligence wing of the organization. And within it, they have an entire division devoted just to health applications. They've been working with a hospital called Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, in the UK. And they've developed a system that helps read digital images of eyes. Now, the kinds of images that they use in particular are created by something called optical coherence tomography, or OCT scans. And these are very powerful because they can create very detailed and information-rich 3D scans of the back of the eyeball, the retina and the various layers there. this is really useful information because there's so much data there. But at the same time, it's very difficult and very complex to analyze. And it can take even take an expert a long time to study an individual set of scans and to figure out what's going on there. Well, they've created an artificial intelligence system that will look at these scans and diagnose a variety of different kinds of conditions and diseases, from injuries to diabetic vision problems to macular degeneration and so forth. So this isn't all that new. There are other systems that can diagnose based on medical imagery. But here's where this DeepMind system takes it a step further. They use a second neural network to look at all the information that the first artificial intelligence engine has generated. And then it matches them up with what it knows about the diseases and other conditions and comes up with a diagnosis. But more than just the diagnosis, it also rates its confidence level in its conclusions. So this way, physicians just don't get a, oh yeah, this patient has this disease or that condition. They say, 25% sure, I'm 100% sure, I'm 99% sure of my conclusion here. Now, the cool thing about this is this whole process just takes seconds. This means that the results can immediately be flagged, and if there's a diagnosis that looks like it needs attention, it can immediately be flagged and sent to a specialist for further analysis, and presumably this patient will end up getting treatment sooner, and it could prevent vision loss and other complications. So it's not just a smart system, but it's a smart system that can tell you why it's made the decision that it did. You know, they say you can't tell a book by its cover, but I defy you to say that you don't make some snap judgments about a person just by how they look. Not even just how they dress or their body, but even just looking at their face, you probably come up with a conclusion as, you know, this maybe this person is smart, or maybe this person is friendly, or maybe this person is not so bright, or some other conclusion. There's really something behind that. It's true that the facial attributes that we have can reveal information about what goes on inside us. There's a company called Face2Gene, that's face and then the digit 2 and then gene, G-E-N-E, and they've built an AI system, an artificial intelligence system, that looks at patient photos and draws conclusions about their genetic makeup. In fact, they're able to predict whether or not a patient has certain genetic disorders just by looking at their face. Now, this is an interesting system. They're saying it's not to be used for diagnosis, but it can be a way to help screen patients or provide more insight for a clinician. It's only going to be available to doctors, and it's stored in a HIPAA-compliant secure system. The information is depersonalized before it goes into the database where other people can access it. There's a lot of questions about this system and how it might be used or abused. But again, as a screening device, it may be very useful in helping doctors identify whether or not a patient has a genetic condition that might warrant further attention. Okay, I've got a question for you, and I want you to be honest. Do you own a fitness band? Okay, if the answer is yes, are you wearing it now? If you're like most people, you probably wore a fitness band for 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, but then it wasn't telling you much new information, and it was a hassle to keep recharging it and all those details. And it's probably in a kitchen drawer or some other place in your house that you're just not wearing it anymore. This is not uncommon. This is well documented that it's what happens to a lot of the fitness bands. What we really need are fitness trackers that disappear into our lives that you don't have to think about. Well, there's a company that's got an interesting approach to this. It's called Spire, S-P-I-R-E, and they have a thing that they call health tags. And these are tiny little clips that you actually attach to your clothing. It makes it easy because you just get dressed in the morning and the tag is already on your clothing, so you're wearing it. You don't have to think about putting it on. You don't have to think about recharging it because the batteries in these things last for about a year and a half. You don't have to worry about taking them off because they're safe to go through the washing cycles. They're totally machine washable. And they're wireless, so they communicate with an app on your smartphone to upload the data that they get. So you really don't have to think about it. They're just there. They're fairly inexpensive. They're $50 for a single tag, but you can buy them in larger quantities at a time. An 8-pack sells for $300, for example. It's possible to get enough of them to put on most of the clothes that you wear just about every day. And you don't have to think about it. It will do the tracking of your exercise for you just by clipping it onto your clothes and forgetting about it. It's not a perfect solution. And unfortunately, right now, it's only available for Apple iOS. They're planning to come out with an Android system soon. But this whole stick and forget it is a good design. It's a passive design. It means that one less thing for people to think about it when they're trying to track their health and exercise. And it's an interesting move in the right direction. I think that ultimately we're going to be looking at smart clothing that has the sensors built in. But for now, this looks like a pretty interesting intermediate solution.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign looked at why people plug in random USB drives to their computers. Putting a mysterious USB flash drive into your laptop may sound like an ill-advised idea, but a surprising number of people fall for it, and the curiosity probably got the better of them. Nearly 50% of college students plugged in USB drives that they found on the ground into their computers, according to this study. Users connect the drive with the altruistic intention, of course, of finding the owner. These individuals are not technically incompetent. They're college students, and they're really pretty savvy. Another similar study found that 20% of members of the public plug in USB drives that they found in parking lots, picnic tables, and sidewalks. This kind of scam highlights the fact that hackers don't really need high-tech or elaborate technology to deliver their malware. Avoid taking USBs from strangers, even at conferences and other work-related events. These kinds of attacks are becoming less common, but it can be extremely dangerous. Granted, physical access, whether through a CD or USB thumb drive, is the absolute worst thing you can do. It's more common for hackers to use USB drives now that CD-ROMs are on fewer machines or are bought these days. These scams are more likely to work on older, less tech-savvy consumers and small businesses. Do I do it? Yeah, I do it. Except that I always put in unknown drives and download material onto my doorstop. What do I use for a doorstop? It's an old machine, 10 years old, running Windows 7. I actually have another one running Windows 10. And if malware affects it, it doesn't matter. It hasn't destroyed my system. All I do is just do a quick reinstall. I don't need all the necessary updates. Where are we today with cord cutting? The pace of cord cutting in the United States is increasing faster than predicted, according to a new forecast released this week by eMarketer. The analyst firm is now projecting the number of those ditching their subscriptions to cable and satellite TV will climb this year to reach 33 million people, a figure that's higher than the 27.1 million cord cutters it had estimated around this time last year. The report points out that partnerships between traditional pay TV companies and over-the-top providers such as Netflix haven't helped to stem the tide of cord cutting. Most United States pay TV providers, including Dish, Charter, and Comcast, offer integrations with Netflix, but cord cutters are more interested in just Netflix and other streaming services, not in pay TV plus Netflix. These partnerships are still in the early stages, so we don't foresee them having a significant impact reducing churning or cord cutting this year. With more pay TV and over-the-top partnerships expected in the future, combined with other strategies, providers could eventually slow but not stop the losses. That said, pay TV subscribers today still far outnumber cord cutters. There are 186.7 million U.S. adults watching cable, satellite, or telco-provided pay TV in 2018, compared with 33 million projected cord cutters. However, the number of pay TV subscribers is down 3.8% over last year, which is a little bit higher than the 3.4% drop in 2017. Meanwhile, streaming services are gaining because of the pay TV losses, and eMarketer increased its estimates for several streaming services' viewership numbers as a result. Now it forecasts YouTube will have 192 million U.S. viewers in 2018, followed by 148 million for Netflix, 89 million for Amazon, 55 million for Hulu, and 17 million for HBO Now, and 7 million for Sling TV. These figures are higher than currently reported subscriber numbers. For example, Hulu today says it has 20 million subscribers. Sling TV has 2.3 million. Netflix has 57 million. But eMarketer isn't tracking subscribers. It's estimating viewers, which it says is any individual of any age watching the streaming service at least once a month. That means it's accounting for households with multiple people, including children. The firm says cord cutters are attracted to the platforms not just because of the low cost, but also the original programming. The main factor fueling growth of on-demand streaming platforms is the original content. Consumers increasingly choose services on the strength of programming that they're offered, and the platforms are stepping up with billions in spending on premium shows. Another factor driving the acceleration of cord cutting is the availability of compelling and affordable live TV packages that are delivered via the internet without the need for installation fees or hardware. For most people, they are subscribers to one of the major internet service providers, which offer the internet, TV channels, and telephone service. The cost of this triple play, when coupled with a cell phone, costs the average user an estimated $3,000 a year from their net income. Whereas the median income today is about $60,000 a year, the net is somewhere between $35,000 to $40,000. Your media expense is almost 10% of your net income. Cord cutting refers to cutting the telephone expense and rely solely on the portable cell phone. 52% today rely on just the cell phone. Cutting the landline or VoIP telephone is a no-brainer. The more difficult aspect of cord cutting is the TV portion. It may or may not be economically feasible. Depends what is your mix of television channels that is of interest to you and relevant to you. Older people still watch more live TV, but that's changing. Millennials don't watch live TV most of the time. Of the video millennials do watch, 35% come from streaming services like Netflix or on-demand video from a pay TV. They spend 20% of their viewing time watching recorded shows off their DVR. Millennials mostly watch TV after it's aired. Older people still watch more live TV, but that's starting to change. Millennials don't watch live TV most of the time. People age 18 to 34 spend 55% of their video watching time consuming content after it's already aired on live TV, according to a new study from Consumer Technology Association. Only 45% of that time is spent with a live television. Of the video millennials do watch, 35% come from streaming services like Netflix or on-demand video from a pay TV. They spend 20% of their viewing time watching recorded shows off their DVR. The switch to time-shifted TV puts further pressure on TV networks that are struggling to make their shows attractive to advertisers and retain audiences. Audiences that are increasingly seeking out entertainment elsewhere, such as on Snapchat and Facebook. That's one of the key reasons why advertisers still pay a lot of money to be next to sports contents like the NFL despite its flattening audience. Sports still compel people to watch live. People older than 35 do spend a majority of their viewing time, or 66%, with live TV. To counter this, the major ISP who offer television channels charge a higher price for internet without TV. Depending on what television channels you need on the internet, the total cost of some subscription service does not offer any real savings because of the higher cost for internet service. The total cost to TV channel subscription varies all over the country. There is no hard and fast guidelines to know if cord cutting is feasible for you. There are television programs on the internet that are free. And what services are there? The Roku Channel, all one word. Pluto TV, all one word. Sony Crackle, that's C-R-A-C-K-L-E. Tubi, T-U-B-I. And Popcorn Flix, F-L-I-X, it's all one word. Clearly, the Roku Channel has found favor among many cord cutters and is taking on long entrenched services like Pluto TV and Tubi. Try out these channels. I've tried them out and it's quite interesting. A lot of movies and I don't have time to watch them. Do you know who has your personal data? It's a mantra that I've been using at the start of each broadcast. Do you know who has your data? And what are they doing with that data? Have you heard of Google Timeline? What is Google Timeline? I recently received an email from Google Timeline, and Google has information on me of dates going back to 2009. What is Google Timeline? Google Timeline can be accessed via google.com/maps, M-A-P-S, /timeline, T-I-M-E-L-I-N-E. Google first introduced this during the summer of 2015. Timeline is sort of like a life log tool. It tracks all the places you visited over a specific period of time. Wait, how did they have history on me that dates back to 2009? How accurate is it? I guess I shouldn't be helping them do quality assurance of their product. The information is only where I've been in the 48 contiguous states. If you had been traveling overseas, it was not recorded. If you've been to Alaska or Hawaii, it seems to also miss that fact, too. The places cited were not 100% accurate, but boy, it was pretty damn close. I was recently dining at a particular restaurant and was misidentified as a next-door restaurant. Can you imagine if it wasn't a restaurant, but it was a funeral home and I started getting information on different styles of caskets? Now we have Facebook, where their primary revenue is from over 98 data points of information they have collected on you in their database. Facebook keeps ads useful and relevant in four distinct ways. It tracks your on-site activity, such as the pages you like and the ads you click and the devices and location settings, such as the brand of phone you use and your type of internet connection. Your personal data has become the product they sell to advertisers. Just remember, you are the product. Facebook began speaking with hospitals last year about the possibility of matching anonymized user profiles with health data in an effort to improve medical care. Facebook has since said it hit pause on the program, and many hospitals have suspended discussions with Facebook to do this. Presumably, following the Cambridge Analytica scandal, the focus on doing a better job of protecting people's data and being clearer about how it's used. Look what happened. Now Facebook has announced up to 90 million accounts may have been breached. They have stated that they don't know what the information have been accessed, but they're pretty sure that no real information was breached. Now wait a minute. If you don't know what was accessed, how can you say that? But if you think it's just a big tech that has your information under the radar, is the federal government. There is a census data that are individually identifiable. The term publicly available is used by the government and is intended to refer to record sets that are truly readily available to the broad public, such as census data. Not to be outdone, the Board of Elections in the nation readily make available their data to, of course, politicians who use it to, well, get information to you or to contact you. The information goes back to over 20 years. Even if you moved or changed party affiliations, the information is tracked. When I first read the science fiction novel 1984 by George Orwell, I didn't think it would be reality. Columbus Day is a federal holiday observed October the 8th this year. Back on October the 12th, 1492, Columbus set sail for India. At that time, there was no crowdfunding and there was no internet. So Columbus got funding from Queen Isabella. It was a gamble. This untested belief that the riches of India could be within easy grasp by sailing west instead of east. Similarly, many of today's tech vendors seem to feel there are riches to be had from home automation, and Mart explains how they sometimes head in the wrong direction and really, but occasionally, end up discovering interesting new worlds. Marty, why don't you just give us a more detailed explanation while I head off with my appointment to see Queen Isabella.
Columbus Day happens next week, twice. Once as a U.S. holiday, and again later in the week as the more literal anniversary. And that got me to thinking about several related topics, like the similarities between the shelter a boat provides and the shelter a house provides, and about panhandling. In the months before his historic trip west, Columbus may have encountered panhandlers on the streets, but there was no crowdfunding, no Indiegogo, no Kickstarter, no GoFundMe. He had to count on his idea attracting a rich lady, Queen Isabella. Well, the premise was very attractive, a shortcut to the riches of India, but an enormous gamble. In a technology context, what is today's parallel to that shortcut to India? What is it that attracts people seeking riches? The home automation category and the ever-changing collection of products being postulated as under the IoT, the Internet of Things, well, under that umbrella, those are good candidates. A few decades ago, you might have said dot-coms, or smartphones, or drones, or autonomous cars. There are always people and companies wanting to set a course along a rainbow because they're convinced of a pot of gold on the other side. Now, do you think many of those efforts just might be false starts? Abso-facto-lutely, but sometimes false starts by one explorer lead to positive changes in direction for others. I'm not forgetting that I said I talk about how houses and boats are similar as shelters. That's still a few minutes away right now. I want to get into some examples of dead ends that led others to better ends, or will. One of my fairly recent favorites is EcoVent, a product you will never be able to buy. They started with the idea of a ventilation register, you know, that thing with the slots, lets heated or conditioned air blow into a room. They added some sensors and a motorized curtain with 1,000 settings that could vary how much air could flow through. And they connected it all up to a control gateway so the system could adjust the curtains room by room to bring the whole house into temperature harmony. If the house has rooms that warm or cool faster than others, no problem. The system could tweak the airflow until each and every room was at the temperature you set at the thermostat, all heating or cooling evenly. Do you have a room you're not using? Tell it to the controller. Shut the door, and the temperature in that room will be allowed to vary more widely. The whole system could get rid of a lot of overkill and underkill in how HVAC works, meaning lower energy bills. And testing showed that it would also mean less wear and tear on the HVAC equipment, meaning a longer time before that would need major repairs or replacement. Speak in my language. So where did that lead? Well, you're not seeing it yet. But several of the companies that make dampers, you see them as levers outside the ventilation ducts that move plates on the inside where they act like airflow valves. Well, those are now becoming more controllable. While dampers that you can electrically open wide or shut down have been around for a good while, one place those are used is in exhaust vents where you wouldn't want to leave the outside air path open when the fan's not blowing. Well, the new refinements go beyond full open and full closed to offer an almost continuous range of degrees of openness. That's thanks to adding some more sophisticated motors and sensors to where the dampers go in the ductwork. Now, they're not quite ready for residential buyers yet. The control systems and sensors need to be more fully integrated, along with some way to cooperate with a real or virtual thermostat. but they're a great example of how a promising but false start by one company set a precedent that really can come true. Okay, let's get on the boat. All right, boats, for the company of explorers that Columbus led. They didn't need to carry fuel for propulsion. They were wind-powered. They did need small amounts of fuel for cooking, and maybe for some lighting, though that could have been all candles. The only fresh water available to them was on board, in barrels. And these were not huge ships. Cargo capacity was limited, which also meant limits to the crew size. What did they use for heating and cooling? Mostly clothing. For food? My guess is more fish than anything else. Reportedly, those sailors slept on the deck of their caravel-style ships on the way over, but saw the natives in the West Indies using hammocks and quickly switched to that as their favored bedding for the return trip. On land, you could heat a cabin or a lean-to or even a cave by burning wood, but the land has a lot more trees than do the seas. More fresh water, too. So let's get back to that cabin, or more fairly, let's call it a cottage. In those days, how did you build a caravel or a cottage? It was no longer a time for log cabins as the norm. Both ships and cottages tended to be built with planks. The sides of cottages might be sealed with some variation on mud or plaster. The planks of maritime vessels were usually sealed with tar. It's unlikely that your house today is built in quite the same way. Unless it's really old, it probably doesn't have real planks. Caravels and cottages, as well as most modern homes, tend to have some kind of inner skeleton, the framing to which the outer envelope could be fastened. In those days, that outer envelope was planking with an inner application of plaster, or for the wealthy, wood panels. Today, the outer envelope tends to be a backing board with siding attached, rolls of fluffy fiberglass insulation in the walls, and drywall on the inside. And the main reason our homes today seem more comfortable than what we might imagine of those old cottages and caravels comes down to one factor: brute force. We burn fuels and run fans to create heating or cooling, and we're seldom bashful about cranking up how much of that we demand whenever the mood strikes. Ponder this, if you will. What if we had some of today's energy-saving build products around back then, even without being able to add a modern heat pump? If the hull of a ship and the walls of a cottage could be made from SIPs, that structural insulated panels, the sandwich of engineered wood panels around high-density foam, if those could be made with SIPs, it would take a lot longer for outside temperatures to get indoors. Ditto for insulated windows. A layer of foam on the underside of whatever's topmost, the underside of the deck for a ship, the underside of a roof for a cottage, well, that also helps isolate those inside spaces. None of this really adds cooling to a warm house or warming to a chilly house or ship, but it all keeps abrupt outside temperature changes from being as uncomfortable as they could be. It slows down and softens their impact. So let's try a little mental exercise, like an imagination game, but tempered by your experience. Do you have or have you ever been inside one of those outdoor storage sheds where people like to keep things like shovels, lawn gear, rakes, hoses, that kind of thing? Inside those, there are no breezes to cool anything. The walls get hot when the weather's hot or when there's a lot of sun. The inside is cold when it's frigid outside or when they're covered by snow. How would that be different if that storage shed had all those insulation measures in place? Well, the biggest thing you'd notice is that the ceiling and the walls aren't radiating heat, and they're not conducting the cold. You may or may not find that more comfortable, but you would almost certainly find that to be a lot less uncomfortable. Let's give that same thought to an outdoor doghouse. To put it bluntly, it's shelter, and might make a difference in the comfort, well-being, or even survival of your dog. So, today, when you think of Columbus and his crew, setting sail on a voyage of discovery with absolutely no assurance of where they might end up or if they would even survive. Remember, the lore of the day said they would be sailing off the edge of the world. You really have to give them credit for daring and endurance. You really have to respect the gumption and courage it took just to keep going. And you really now have a much better grasp on why their bold adventure still deserves to be honored in our time. Remember, you have an everyday option that they chose not to take. You, at least, can back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on the Adobe Premiere Elements 2018. Thursday, October the 4th, meeting time is at 7 p.m., and it will be held at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their meeting October the 5th at 8 p.m. at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting Thursday, October the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and I've been asked to give a presentation, and I'm going to be talking about Back to the Future with graphical and command line utilities under the hood of Windows. Meeting will be held at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group will be meeting Friday, October the 12th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall at the New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. Princeton PC Users Group has their general meeting Tuesday, October the 23rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they hold their meeting in the community room of the Princeton Public Library at 65 Witherspoon Street in Princeton, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer User Group will have their meeting on Thursday, October the 25th at 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Computer Lab at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting Tuesday, November the 6th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m. They meet at 24 Hospital Avenue in Danbury, Connecticut.
The Ewing Computer Learning Center has their meeting on the first Tuesday of the month, beginning at 1:30 p.m. They meet in the meeting room at the Ewing Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey.
All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. I hope we'll be seeing you at one of these club meetings.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York on the radio, or BAI.org streaming on the internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.